This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 436 for September 21 of 2018. Bob Lutz, live and unleashed, and yes, he talks about Tesla. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Autoline After Hours. Hey, we got Bob Lutz in here. We'll get to that in a second. But if you'd like to ask questions of us and our guest and the panel here, shoot us an email. Send it to viewermail@autoline.tv. And we'll take phone calls, too. And that number is 620-288-6546. We've already gotten a number of questions from a bunch of you. We're going to try to get to as many as we can. So as the show goes on, keep them coming in. If you want to call, try to keep your question to 30 seconds or less. The shorter it is, the more likely we are to get it.
That's for sure.
Okay, on with the show. So, Mr. Gary Vasilash, how do you do, sir?
I'm doing great. I think this is probably the only time you're going to hear from me during the show because the number of questions that have come in already for Bob is enormous. So it's going to be a hell of a show.
And we got to let everybody know Henry Payne from the Detroit News, the car critic from the Detroit News, is with us.
Yeah, hey, John.
And
nice
cartoonist.
Yeah, do some cartoons as well. Yeah.
And racing. You were racing at Watkins Glen this past weekend?
Yeah, I had a very good weekend. Got beat by my son, which is always, every dad is proud of that. When the next generation, every generation should be faster than the last.
Mm-hmm.
So,
there you go.
You know,
we're
very excited about that.
We had Henry on the show as a racer, as a guest. Remember?
We had his car in the studio.
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay.
Best auto line ever.
So, until today.
That's right, until Lutz came on.
Okay. So you guys were first and second?
He was pole. He was on pole. He finished second, and I was fourth.
Okay.
So good showing for the Paynes.
Yeah.
One
podium finish for the family.
Yeah, almost got podium for both. Okay. Yeah. He was on podium. I was taking the pictures.
Next time.
Yeah.
And, of course, as I've said, special guest Bob Lutz, and it's great to have you here on the show, Bob.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
We got a zillion things to talk about, but we got a lot of questions. In fact, Martin Sinzig wants to know, too. What do you make of this mid-engine Corvette? What are your thoughts about it?
Well, we've waited a long time for it. I'm personally very excited about it. I obviously have asked to be considered for early delivery of whatever comes out. But the unfortunate thing is I think the first year or two will be a conventional mid-engine Corvette, probably with an LS3 of 420 or 430 horsepower, which will be a fast car. But they'll probably wait 2 years to bring out a Z06 with, 650 or 700 or 720 or whatever. And then at some point there will be a new ZR1, and that's probably 4 years out, and that'll probably be north of 800 horsepower. It's speculation, I have to say right away. I don't know. But that'll probably be the four-cammer with twin turbos or whatever, and will be a super-fast car. But 4 years from now, I'm almost 87, and do I really need a car with 800 and some or 900 horsepower when I'm 91?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Might. Exactly. You might.
Yeah, you have to compensate declining physical capability with something.
Mm-hmm. So why the need for a mid-engine? Is it because all the other cars in its class have gone there? All the cars that Corvette races against now are mid-engine cars. Is that the thing that's driving Corvette to do it?
Well, sure, and plus the fact that the Corvette is kind of a symbol of the pinnacle of GM technology. So I think Chevrolet believes correctly, or GM believes correctly, or Mark Royce believes correctly, that you cannot market your premium sports car with anything but the latest technology. And the truth is, as Tadge Uechtert told me at the time, we wanted to do the original mid-engine Corvette, which was just before the 07-08 financial meltdown, which, you know, canceled that plan. He came to me and said, the next one's got to be mid-engine. And I said, why? And he said, because we're at the limit of what we can achieve with the conventional rear drive front mid-engine layout. We're just not transferring enough weight to the rear axle, et cetera, et cetera. And he had a whole presentation demonstrating it. And I saw the presentation. I said, Tadge, I think you're right. We went to Rick Wagner. The reaction was the same. Rick said, oh, no, we're not going to do that. The Corvette is value for money sports car. We're not going to try to emulate Lamborghini and so forth. I said, well, Rick just watched the presentation. And at the end, he said, well, yeah, I guess we better. Well, in the fullness of time, we had to cancel that very investment-intensive program, and we had to do one more iteration off of the C6, which turned out to be the C7, where Tadge was able to milk a little bit more chassis performance out of it, partially by a 2-inch wheelbase extension. But now I think we're at the absolute end, and I think on the ZR1, the C7 ZR1, on most tracks, unless they have very long straightaways, is not going to be significantly faster than the Z06 for the very reasons that Tadge explained to me. He said, I don't care how much horsepower you put into it, at some point you're not going to get it usefully on the ground anymore. And I said, Tadge, but what about the new ZR1? And he said, well, we've got all these aerodynamic aids and we've got a lot of downforce. And I said, well, but here's a question. If you put all that stuff on a Z06, would it do the same thing? And he said, well, I'm not going to speculate on that. But the answer is, to achieve superior lap times, the car has to go mid-engine. Now, is that a good solution for the average person who just wants a nice sports car? Maybe, maybe not. But first of all, they're going to keep the mid-engine affordable. It'll probably be a little more expensive than the C7, but it will still be a highly affordable car.
What number do you think? 60,000?
I would say take, and again, once the same disclaimer again, I have no knowledge of this whatsoever, but if I were still there, I would, first of all, I'm sure that the mid-engine was subject to very tight cost control, and the goal was probably to make it insignificantly more expensive than a C7. And I would just assume that you take whatever C7 level and add $5,000. That would be my guess.
Well, and you know, this isn't, unlike some of the mid-engine competitors that John mentioned that they're facing in the racing world these days, this isn't a carbon fiber tub. So they're keeping, you know, this is still an aluminum chassis Corvette like the front engine.
Sure.
You know, they're keeping their costs down there.
Keeping it manufacturable.
That's right.
But I would not be surprised. And I have a good friend down in Atlanta who owns a Ford GT, and I said he has the world's fastest V6 business coupe. I forecast that the better versions of the mid-engine Corvette, the higher horsepower versions, are going to put a Ford GT on the trailer.
Well, and we just got Car and Driver just published their lightning lap for this year, and the ZR1 at VIR, long course VIR,
course where the horsepower comes into play.
Outlapped the Ford GT by 5 seconds.
Wow.
Wow.
Which is a huge number.
That's stunning.
Yeah.
It may as well be 5 centuries.
Yeah, 4 seconds. There's 4 seconds.
Okay, 4 seconds.
Yeah, but still, yeah.
It's enough.
What about making it a hybrid, a version of it? Because all the performance stuff is going some sort of electrification.
Here's my speculation. The car was originally supposed to come out about 2.5 years ago. And it kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed. And my suspicion is the reason for the delay, and again, pure speculation on my part. I have no knowledge of the facts whatsoever. But my speculation is that in order to be environmentally acceptable and semi-politically correct, at least one version will be a plug-in hybrid with a small battery, which will, you know, rapidly recharge, and electric motors on the front axle, so that when you're coming out of a corner, you draw down that battery, essentially with all-wheel drive. But the front wheels will be electrically driven, which could also come into play in winter if anybody is foolhardy enough to take a Corvette out in snow and ice. But I would imagine that the product planners may have decided, let's have a low-speed feature, too, to where if you're trying to move out from an intersection that's covered with hard-packed snow or ice, you can select the drive to the front wheels. Again, pure speculation on my part. And,
but I mean, there's also enormous performance possibilities.
Oh, yeah.
With all-wheel drive and electric motors in the front. We were talking a couple years ago in the Detroit News, and we were reporting out some of the initial stuff on mid-engine car, and you and another ex-GM engineer were speculating on just what you can do with electric motors up front. And now that you got four-wheel traction, now you can talk about 1,000 horsepower and insane 0 to 60 times.
Momentarily, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just like what Acura's done with the NSX.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. If you were still at GM, would you also do a Cadillac version?
Well, that was planned with the original program. And what we had planned for the Cadillac was, at the time, the Noble 4-cam engine, and the Corvette was going to stay with pushrods. And and they had completely different bodies. The Corvette was very Corvette-themed, angular, a little bit jagged, and the Cadillac was going to be the successor to the XLR. And it was just gorgeous. We had the full-size model painted in a sort of a mother-of-pearl tri-coat silver, you know, and it was absolute dynamite. I mean, I wept real tears when that program.
So, Bob, for those who don't know, and I can't imagine anybody doesn't, so you retired from General Motors as vice chairman in 2010. Is that Cadillac the car that you wished would have been fully developed before you left?
Oh, sure.
I mean, of all the cars that you...
Oh, yeah. That would have been the car to keep for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Well, and Johann Denischen, when he was there, slipped that they were developing that car. I always thought with Denischen coming in from Audi, he basically wanted to recreate the Audi lineup for Cadillac. And Audi's got that R8 halo sitting there. Makes a lot of sense if you're investing all that money into a mid-engine plant in Bowling Green. It makes sense to make a Cadillac version.
But, you know, it would have to be substantially different. It would have to be far more refined. It would have to have a far more expensive interior. It would have to have far different features and radically different styling. So that, and it's hard. As, you know, Ed Welburn would be the first to tell you, it's hard these days to make a mid-engine sports car look different from the flock of mid-engine sports cars that are already out there. I think Ford achieved that very nicely with the GT, but predominantly thanks to that very long tail. Mm-hmm. Take away that very long tapering back end, you know, the sort of in your mind's eye chop off 12 to 18 inches of it, and it's going to look like, once again, pretty much anybody else's mid-engine car.
Yeah.
Because of the basic architecture and the layout of passengers and engines and everything, you're going to basically wind up with similar-looking cars. I will give the Audi R8 credit for looking different. I'm not sure it looks different in a good way, but it does look different.
Bob is also the part of the argument for the mid-engine Corvette that car was on the chopping block or was at least delayed through the Great Recession. I mean,
it was canceled.
Yeah, because you'll just never get the volumes with sports cars that you get with larger production cars. But by going mid-engine and you open up these technology options like hybridization, can you stretch? The envelope of that car so you can make more money up at the high end on more trim levels and make Corvette more viable going forward?
Well, yes. And, you know, now you've got Ford Motor Company talking about spreading the Mustang magic to other types of vehicles. And that's what you and I have talked about on various occasions is Corvette
SUV.
Is it just a Chevrolet model, or could Corvette become a separate brand? I think Corvette is one of those brands that, just like Porsche went from two-seat rear-engine sports cars, and now they have a whole lineup, including SUVs. It's not something you would ever put in a separate dealer body for, because the volume would never carry it, but you'd have select Chevrolet dealers handle that. And I think there is latent value in the Corvette name and Corvette reputation that could be moved to other types of vehicles without hurting the Corvette brand. But, you know, there's a lot of reasons to do it, there's also a lot of reasons not to do it. And GM already has Cadillac as its premium vehicle, and that brand needs all the attention it can get, because the recovery of Cadillac as a credible international luxury car is still a work in progress. So I don't think we'll see an extension of the Corvette name to other architectures. And if it did happen, it would trigger substantial additional investment, because you couldn't just take General Motors' large medium sized crossover architecture like the Chevy Avalanche, Chevy Traverse, and put a Corvette body and bigger engine in it, because the public would find you out. So whatever you did would have to be. Pure and unique Corvette, maybe shared with Cadillac, which wouldn't dilute the image of either brand, but you'd have to be careful that you created a substantially new architecture for whatever you do, and that takes a lot of money and drives a lot of engineering complexity, parts complexity, and so forth. And at this stage in the automobile business, I don't think that's something that GM wants to do.
But why would that be the case? Hmm? I mean, why? Because they're spending money on autonomy and...
As sad as it makes me, but the days of the automobile industry as we know and love it and have all lived it our careers, those days are numbered. And you see the symptoms everywhere. And as I said in my recent SAE speech, which John said, the death of the automobile industry is not so much... autonomous vehicles, yeah, someday it'll be killed by autonomous modules and robo-taxis. But that's not the immediate threat. The immediate threat is that for the last 20 years or so, we have taken step after step after step after step to de-emphasize vehicle ownership. First it was with, you know, ultra-long payment periods because the American public doesn't think of MSRPs. The American public and the dealers... You talk pricing with dealers. They say, "Well, that one should be about $450. $450 what? $450 a month. We need a $450 a month lease, and that's all they talk about is monthly payments, which is now why we have 80 month plus paper. Then we have leasing, which is smart companies constrain it to maybe 25 to 30% of sales, but if you would open the strings." Leasing would practically take over. Why? Because the customer on a 36-month lease is only covering the first 36 months of depreciation on the car, plus, you know, a profit for the leasing company. But nobody takes ownership. And then you've got stuff like ride sharing. Very convenient. Very, very convenient. You're still moving with automobiles, but no ownership. And then you've got subscription services where you pay a fee of maybe $1,000 or $1,300 a month. And on various days, you can have any car in that particular lineup. Again, the convenience of the automobile, but no ownership. And I think what made the automobile great and desirable is that people saved up and saved up and saved up and finally owned it. And when it was finally yours and sitting in the driveway, you just couldn't stop looking at it. Mm-hmm. And when you walked to the front door, you turned around one last time and said, wow, I can't believe that I own that. Well, nobody does that with a lease car.
Yeah, well, it's like buying your first house versus renting apartments.
Yeah. And it's the we have systematically, I think, as an industry, destroyed pride of ownership. Then the other thing that's happened is forced by competition, the automobile industry, every major manufacturer has filled every conceivable niche and even some imagined niches which they thought were there and turned out not to be. But you pick anything, any sort of medium-sized crossover, you've got 20 or 30 competitors that, if they're properly designed, which not all of them are, you know, you always recognize the ugly ones, but the well-designed ones look alarmingly alike, to where if you're not within sight distance of the badge, you really don't know whether it's Hyundai, Kia, Nissan, Buick, et cetera, et cetera. And that also gnaws away at the individuality and the pride of ownership of owning. Because now, let's say you go to a dealer and you get a new midsize crossover, Brand X. Take it home. The neighbors aren't going to notice. Whereas in the old days, you brought something new home and, you know, the stores would empty and the neighborhood kids would all come over and say, wow, Mr. Lutz, is that your new car? Well, today nobody notices. So I think that's, for whatever reason, there is a declining, and as I say, David E. Davis, I quoted him at the SAE meeting. David E. Davis one time addressed GM management in the so-called management club. It was before I got back. And he said, the problem with General Motors is that nowhere in this great land of ours breathes there a 14-year-old boy with tears in his eyes saying, please, Dad, let's get a Lumina. And,
but, Bob,
well,
but
that 14-year-old boy is now applicable to every brand out there.
But.
And that 14-year-old boy, what he wants is a new smartphone and an Uber subscription.
Yeah. But at the same time, we are in a sort of a second golden age of the performance vehicle. You go back to the 60s and you had all of a sudden Mustang, Dodge, Challengers sprung out of the manufacturer.
This time around, young people can't afford them.
Especially
the insurance.
But this time around, Miata, Subaru 86,
you're helping Kia, make my
Kia,
point.
Kia Stinger. I mean, there's always sort of been this appliance buyer versus the enthusiast buyer.
You're helping to make my point. Mm-hmm. Even in the performance end of the business, there's so much stuff out there that there's an embarrassment of riches. And I think whether it's Gothic architecture or something, it was always at its pinnacle before the whole thing went away. And I'm not saying it's going to be next year or 3 years from now, but we're definitely on a slightly declining and maybe at some point accelerating downward curve in terms of automotive interest and general public lust for new and different and spectacular automobiles.
There's another point that I'd like you to pick up on, how just about anybody can afford any brand.
Yeah, that's true.
If you can afford $400 a month, then you take it.
If you can afford $400 a month, there's no limit to the brands you can own, quote unquote, or the brands that you can drive home with. And then you get this inversion where, a Mercedes C-Class or, you know, one category below that may have a $450 a month lease for 36 months. But a new Chevy crossover, like the new
Blazer
Traverse, that might be $650. So you've got premium brands that are available at a lower monthly rate than non-premium, new and sought-after models by the non-premium manufacturers. And then you've got price inversion, too. Nobody knows this, but if you say, who is in the United States the purveyor of the highest number of cars retailing at over $60,000? People would say, well, it's got to be BMW or Mercedes-Benz. No, it's not. It's Chevrolet.
Trucks.
Yeah, trucks.
Don't people have that shifted their appeal from sedans to their full-size pickups, that they buy these, they like these, they polish these?
What we used to see in cars, like mine's bigger, mine's got more horsepower, mine's got more torque, mine tows more horses, that is still reasonably alive and well in the pickup truck segment. That's where the good old boys, they still notice each other's trucks.
Right.
Oh, man, why'd you get a Ram? Well, let me tell you why I got a Ram, you know. It's more alive in the truck segment, pickup truck segment, than anywhere else.
So again, I think maybe people don't realize this, but the Ram that we know today is thanks to you when you were back at Chrysler and saying, I want something that is going to...
Well, that was an interesting story. Dodge was down to less than 50,000 Ram pickups a year. And if you look at the Boston Consulting Company, their thing is, if you're in an industry with multiple entrants and your two major competitors have over 90% of the market and you have the rest, that's a business to get out of. Don't try to horn your way back in. Well, we tried to horn our way back in. And we basically took the philosophy, first of all, it's got to look different. It's got to be have a polarizing appearance. And if only one in four people like it, that 25% will really love it. And then we made sure it had the right engines, the right transmissions, the right hauling capacity. And within 2 or 3 years, we were back to essentially one-third, one-third, one-third. So it was a huge success, but it took a tremendous investment and a great amount of courage to do it. And there were no shortage of people along the way who said, oh, man, that looks funny. Are you sure about that front end? And we said, and every clinic we did, it had come back the same way. 75% of people hated it, and the other 25% said, whose truck is it? I don't care who makes it, but when that comes out, I'm buying it. And that's what you go for. You go for a polarizing design, even if it's not shared with the majority of people. But if you're at 5% market share or less, and you have something that's going to be bought by 25% of the people, you know you've got a winner.
So how did you keep that design in not fall prey to someone saying, well, you know, Bob, 25% is good, but if we just change that, we'll get 35.
You mean, how come we didn't blanderize it?
Yeah.
Because the three people in charge who basically made all the decisions, which is Francois Castin, Tom Gale, and myself, just said, guys, it is what it is. Just like the original Viper, the program was handed to Dodge Marketing, and Dodge Marketing said, oh, well, this will never do. It's way too expensive. So what we need is a V8 version with an automatic transmission. And then, of course, we'll need a power top, and we'll need a coupe, and we need full air conditioning and so forth. And I said to Francois Castaing, stop these guys. And Francois said, no, just let them dream their little dream of base versions and option up to a larger engine and option up, et cetera, et cetera. It'll collapse of its own weight. Mm-hmm.
And it did.
Yeah. But they were finally at, I think, $450 million for a program where we had a $50 million budget. We said, okay, here's what it's going to have. A top that you have to assemble when it starts to rain, side curtains like an old MGTC, no ABS, no factory air, manual transmission only in one engine. What is this? Basically an option-free automobile. And that's how we were able to keep the program to actually, the one change we made was when Chrysler owned Lamborghini, Lambo said, you know what? We could do that engine for you in aluminum without a great deal of trouble. We know exactly what we change, but we have experience in this, and we can get you that, was it 300 and odd? We would have been able to get the cast iron engine to 400 horsepower, but it was still this enormous cast iron V10 lump. With small intake valves, everything in Lamborghini changed it all for us, did it in aluminum, got the intake valves to where, I swear, a kitten could have crawled through the intake ports without any difficulty. And so that took the program from 50 to 60, but it was a tightly controlled program. And would we have liked to have power windows? Sure. An ABS? Yes. And I don't think there was an automatic transmission at the time that could take that torque, but we had to eschew all of that. And that's where you have to, somebody in charge has to maintain program discipline and say, yes, that would be nice to have. Yes, it would get us additional customers, but right now we can't afford it. You know, maybe we'll do it 3 years down the road if this thing is successful.
Do you see guts like that in the industry right now?
Pardon?
Guts to do that now in the industry? I mean, are there guys like you calling the shots anywhere?
I'm sure there's the discipline, and at General Motors, I know that Mary has that discipline. Mark Royce does. Mark Royce will say, "Okay, that's enough. We're not doing anymore." And if all else fails, you've got the finance guys, who. And, you know, I wrote the book Car Guys versus Bean Counters, and even in that I acknowledge where it goes wrong is if you let the bean counters run the company. Then, but just like you need brakes in a car, even though brakes have to come after you've got the right drivetrain, but even the right drivetrain needs brakes. And to me, the finance guys can help steer, and they are the brakes. And they deserve a position of importance in any automobile company, and they have it. But, you know, I always get worried. If they don't have enough say, the company will run itself into Chapter 11. If they have too much say, the product suffers, and people open the door and say, holy smoke, what happened to this interior? It's all black plastic. And then the product suffers. So getting that balance right is very difficult, and various companies have it more right at various times than others. But that's all a question of leadership. If you make things too democratic, it doesn't work, because then they'll sit in a meeting and take a vote.
Yeah. Hey, wait. We got to take a quick break here. We got a whole lot more to talk about with Bob Lutz, but now we're going to give a shout-out to our good friends and sponsor at BorgWarner.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Okay, we're back talking with Bob Lutz, but I want to check, are you following us on social media? You should check us out at facebook.com/Autoline Network. Follow us on Twitter at Autoline, or follow us on Instagram at Autoline Network. And if you want to keep up on everything that we're doing, that's a great way to be able to do it. So, Bob, we've got a question here from Miro Caffert, who wants to know, what's your daily driver?
Well, there are several, depending on my mood and the weather, but it could be anything from a Camaro convertible to my ZR1, one of my several Pontiac Solstices. I'm trying to corner the market on those. Or it could be my GMC Denali pickup truck, or the one that's right in front of the back door and that my wife and I get into most frequently is my Yukon Denali, 2015 Yukon Denali XL, with the 6.2-liter engine and cylinder deactivation, which I always tell people, and people find it hard to believe, but you can set the cruise control to 75 to 80, and if the road is flat, it'll run on four cylinders, and you're getting 22 miles per gallon, which for, you know, a 6,000-pound vehicle with 420 horsepower is pretty amazing.
It was 6 liters in magnetic shocks, and it doesn't handle too bad either for a big thing.
It does, and is it? That sucker is fast.
Yeah.
I think it's 0 to 60 in like 5.2 or something like that.
It's a stealth mobile. It's got a Corvette engine under the hood.
Hey, Joey's cleaning lady wrote in to say, can we talk VLF now? Where's that all
sure.
stand?
Well, VLF is in a transitional phase, and right now we've kind of changed because of a lack of supply of chassis and bodies from what is now, the Karma Corporation. And that's a whole nother story. We're now focusing on assembly and distribution of Hummer H1's civilian version, which we have recertified. And we are confident that we will soon be in low-volume production of that vehicle at some point for the United States, but initially for Middle East and China. Mm-hmm. So while the cash flow hasn't been brilliant, things are starting to look up.
Well, that's great to hear. Dave Tuttle wrote in. He's wondering what you think about a plug-in hybrid or battery electric pickup truck. And wouldn't that be a perfect example of making these big vehicles more environmentally friendly?
Well, sure. But it also will increase cost and decrease payload. And, you know, pickups are all about payload. And at this point for hauling, especially something the size of a pickup truck, I think internal combustion applied efficiently is still the best solution. But where the question makes more sense is in things like full-size SUVs, where you could easily package a battery of a certain size. The payload is not going to be like in a pickup truck. It's going to just be your normal, you know, five or six passengers. And those with, say, a 40-mile range battery, which would cover most of the daily urban and suburban trips, that would save a ton of gasoline. And I would imagine if the EPA fuel economy goals don't get drastically modified, everybody's going to have to do that in order to meet the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you mentioned in passing the Solstice, and it strikes me that that's the sort of car that if you drove that into your driveway, that the 14-year-old kid would come over and say, what the hell is that? Now, that's one of your great successes that I think doesn't get talked about enough. Tell us about that program.
Which one is that?
Solstice.
Oh, yeah. Well, we started out trying to recapture the appeal of not only the Mazda Miata, but the, you know, former small British sports cars, which had the advantage of being priced very competitively to where you could buy a BMC Sprite or the MG version for, at the time, about $1,900.
We got a picture of the Solstice up there now, too. It's still a good-looking car.
Well, it's a timelessly elegant design.
Yeah.
And I think it's impossible to do a two-seat sports car that's any purer than the Solstice. And the engineering is, it was fairly easy to do. The rear transaxle is off of a Cadillac CTS. or the diff is off of a Cadillac CTS. The transmission was, I believe, an Eisenwarner. The engine was the General Motors Ecotec 2-liter or 2.4-liter, and I think 2-liter in turbocharged form. So we had all the powertrain components, and we fought because we told ourselves we're going to do this thing for next to nothing. So we scoured every imaginable parts bin, not only from GM, but from any other manufacturers, to where the outside mirrors are off, or I think Fiat, or a Fiat part. Two of the rear lamps, or the secondary rear lamps, are off of a GMC Envoy. And we just took stuff from everywhere to keep the investment low. And that's one where we did have the problem where marketing and a lot of other people said, oh, yeah, but for this to be successful, we can start with a four-cylinder, but then we have to have a V6 option and preferably a small block option as well. Well, the minute you put a bigger engine in, you've got to change the transmission, change the diff, go to bigger brakes, go to a bigger radiator, make everything, change the front end because the larger engines are going to need a bigger air intake. And right away, they say mass, increased mass begets increased mass and cost. And if we had said yes to all that stuff, we never would have been able to afford the program. And I said, this is going to be just like the little Honda sports car and the Miata. You can have any engine you want as long as it's four cylinders. Mm. And the formula worked, and the car was enormously successful and never... And I own one of the turbo coupes, by the way.
Which are kind of rare.
They're rare, and there were four built in GXP, that is, with the 260 horsepower turbo and five-speed manual transmission. Four built, I have one. And mine's black on black with the big wheels and everything. It's just gorgeous. But at any rate, the car was, in the world of two-seat roadsters, very successful, had a very good operating margin, but was killed by the fact that it was originally planned for build in Toluca, Mexico. In a huge deal where all kinds of things were renegotiated with the UAW, it was decided, well, okay, we'll keep the Wilmington, Delaware plant open and we'll put the Solstice in it. So they put the Solstice in Sky, put a 40,000 unit per year automobile into a plant that was sized for 300,000 vehicles a year. And so, yeah, the margin was good, but the allocated fixed costs just killed it. And I at the time that they did that UAW deal, I said, okay, but remember, 3 years from now, when you tell me the Solstice is unprofitable, I'm going to remind you that it was the UAW deal that did it and not the fact that we didn't exercise cost control on the car. Yeah, we'll remember. Oh, 3 years down the road, this thing isn't making any money.
That's too bad.
Hey, this is...
And then Wilmington was a plant we wanted to shut anyway. And post Chapter 11, when we negotiated all the plant closing, Pontiac went away. Now the car could have been transferred to Chevrolet by basically taking the Sky appearance, which was kind of very Chevrolet-like anyway, and take off the Saturn badges and put on a Chevy bow tie. It would have made a very credible Chevrolet. But moving it out of the Delaware plant into some other assembly plant was just financially prohibitive. So, with great reluctance, we let it go.
Yeah.
This should be a good segue then to move into Tesla, because the top designer, the lead design, I believe, on the Solstice was Franz von Holzhauser,
right,
who's now the head of design at Tesla.
Right. Brilliant designer. And I will tell you, electric or not, performance or not, Tesla would not be selling cars today if it weren't for Franz von Holzhauser's design.
That's why I'm buying
the
one.
Car is,
yeah, the design is
the design is such that you tell yourself, and many Europeans tell themselves, I don't care whether it's gasoline or rubber band powered, I want that car.
Mm-hmm.
And a design sells, let's face it. And it's really the first electric car with a truly compelling design. Where a lot of times I think automobile companies went to extremes to make an electrified car look funny so that people would recognize it as being electric. Whereas with the Tesla, it's totally transparent.
Yeah, no, you were able to transform the tree hugger buyer to somebody like me. I mean, I'm not a greenie. I'm a regular old car guy. I'm an oil thirsty, dinosaur. And yet the Model 3 design and performance appeals to somebody like me.
Why wouldn't it? I mean, the cars are, people say, why don't you like Tesla? I say, wait a minute, I love Tesla. And the cars are great. It's the business that sucks.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. You know, a guy loaned me his Model X to drive, and it was a P100D. And I was knocked out by that vehicle, absolutely knocked out. But I separate, you know, to me, it's what you're saying. There's Tesla, the industrial business corporation, which is a disaster.
Right.
And there's Tesla, the design engineering guys who have knocked it out of the park.
Absolutely. Yeah. Totally correct.
Yeah. Nothing like it on the market.
Right.
But
there,
Bob,
soon will be, however.
Well, but that's a question, though. I mean, so back in the hybrid days, and everybody's predicting hybrids are going to be 50% of the market. Toyota Prius comes out. This is the new revolution. Turns out, all people wanted was a Toyota Prius. It's still 50% of the hybrid market. Is it the same with Tesla? I mean, if you bring out Volvo Polestars and Jaguar I-Paces and all this stuff, people will say, that's not an electric car. I want a Tesla.
The brand is strong, no question about it. But Audi is a strong brand. Jaguar is a strong brand with limited distribution. Mercedes is a strong brand. Porsche is a strong brand. Some of the GM brands are at various levels of strength. But when everybody is out there with electric vehicles of equal range and equal performance, some of which will also, I think the Jaguar I-Pace, I think, is a brilliant crossover design.
Yeah.
The upcoming Porsche four-door, 300-mile electric, which when I look at the pictures of the concept car, which is probably very close to production, I tell myself, that's what the Panamera should have been. but they're gorgeous. And I think the Audi e-tron is going to sell between $50,000 and $75,000.
I thought they said $75,000.
For the e-tron, base price is $79,000.
Okay, well, but still.
$795,000.
But I got to tell you,
a lot of money, though.
I just had a Jaguar I-Pace here this week that I was test driving. Very nice car. Mm-hmm. I'd take the Model X over it. I saw the Audi e-tron. It doesn't get my heart racing. The Mercedes.
But it's an Audi.
But it is an Audi. Yeah. I grant you that. And the Mercedes EQC looks to me like the design staff mailed it in. It is not a handsome design in my eye. To my eye, it looks like a 2014 Ford Edge Sport.
Yeah, well, in that case, you know, it's a missed opportunity. But my point is, competition is coming on big time. And every other automobile company is going to be selling their purely electric vehicles at a price to gain market penetration, because they have to meet the law. So they'll do sacrificial pricing, and they can recoup it on the conventional stuff. Tesla might be successful at 5 or 10% or maybe even 15% priced over the German competition. But that's about the limit. And Tesla can't come down and meet the competition price-wise, because if they do that, they have no internal combustion engine vehicles to recoup it on. And that's the big vulnerability, is everybody else can afford losses on the electric vehicles. The volume is going to be relatively low. So, you know, you take 15 or 20,000 vehicles a year times $1,000 a vehicle loss. It's not that bad. You just add $200 to every pickup truck, and you've more than made it up. No, seriously.
What's happening. But if government is forcing battery propulsion, what does that say about the future of the bottom line of the other companies? If Tesla can't make it, and government is forcing electrification,
forcing a certain number of electric vehicles.
California says no ICE engine after 2040.
Well, in that case, the losses in the California market will be made up elsewhere. But the point is, every other company has other places to go.
So they have scale that they can spread
They have scale. First of all, I mean, the Volkswagen Group can basically use the same EV technology in Audi, Volkswagen, Porsche, even Lamborghini if they feel like it. Whereas at Tesla, they've got a gigantic share of mind in the American market, but the actual scale of the company is still tiny. I mean, it's still like under 200,000 cars a year, which is the annual output of one General Motors or Ford assembly plant.
Right. Hey, we're going to have to take another quick break right now. We're going to give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone and Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking with Bob.
To be announced.
Yeah. To be announced. Yeah. We're back talking live with Bob Lutz, but it's that time of the program where we got to bring Dr. Data.
Okay, so since we have Bob here, and as was previously mentioned, he retired from General. You were at General Motors twice, right?
Yep.
And
beginning and end.
Beginning and end.
Other companies sandwiched in between.
Uh-huh. So I have a little quiz for you guys that's related to General Motors. So, Katie, could you bring up the little quiz? So the question is, how many CEOs has General Motors had?
Oh, good.
Okay,
question.
Now I'm going to give you clues. We're going to make this impossible. So bring up the second. Okay, so 11, 13, 14, or 16. Okay, in the entire history of the company. How many?
Oh, I thought this was going to be a trick question.
No, it's a very simple question.
No, these are tightly clustered, so it's hard to pick the right one. But
well, let's see. Durant?
CEOs.
Not founders.
CEOs.
Sloan.
Well, you know,
Sloan is legit.
Okay.
Sloan was the first one.
Yeah.
So that goes back to 1923.
Yeah, and he was into the 50s then.
I'm going to say 13.
I'm going to say 11.
Henry?
13 is my favorite number, so
yeah.
that's how deep I go.
Yeah.
I'll go with 14.
And you know what? You're right.
Wow, lucky me.
So 14. So,
except for one thing, Gary. I believe the term CEO, Chief Executive Officer, did not really appear until the late 80s or early 90s. It was always the chairman and the president.
All right.
And the term CEO is...
I move for a mistrial.
All right, bring it. So here are the people. So we got Sloan, Charles Wilson, Harlow Curtis, James Roche, Richard Gerstenberg, Thomas Murphy, Roger B. Smith, Stemple, Jack Smith, Rick Wagner, Fritz Henderson, Ed Whitaker, Dan Akerson, and Mary Barra. And the thing that I found to be astonishing, that Sloan had by far the longest tenure, 23 years.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, and there's some guys, I mean, that just, it was like...
Well, Whitaker
Ed Whitaker,
like
9 months.
Half or right. 9 months. And,
yeah.
And Fritz had very
8 months.
Short tenure.
Yeah, right.
And, through no fault of his own.
Stemple, 2 years.
I believe if you go back and look at old annual reports or what, I'll bet you either Roger Smith or Bob Stemple were the first ones to have the title CEO. And I believe all the others before that would have been president.
No, president of General Motors always had a duopoly or a duo. There was a chairman.
Right.
And then there was a president.
Right.
And the chairman usually, in the old days, lived in New York and mm-hmm. looked after the finances and the financing. And the president basically ran the whole thing.
Right. But what I'm saying is, up through Tom Murphy, I think Tom Murphy was never called the CEO, only the president.
You may well be right.
I think he's probably right on the CEO thing.
You may well be right. But there was always a chairman and a president.
Here's how I think the term came around, and I think it might have come out of General Motors, is that you had the president of General Motors, but there was also the president of Delco and the president of Guide.
Yeah,
and the,
they all reported.
Well, I know they all reported.
Fisher
but
body.
When you're at a cocktail party and you say, yeah, I'm a president of General Motors, well, then it's like, well, wait a minute.
Well, you can't claim to be the president of General Motors if you're the president of AC Delco.
Yeah, yeah. I think they did. And I think that's how the term chief executive officer came about.
That's an interesting theory, John.
It is a theory.
So
that's
who's
right.
The most interesting person you work for? I mean, General Motors, Chrysler,
I would have
Ford.
I'll break it down into a couple of segments. First of all, the most brilliant intellect of anybody I've ever worked for was unquestionably Rick Wagner. Just one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. You could argue maybe at times, for my taste, a little bit short of pragmatic common sense thinking, but from the way he processed information and developed alternative scenarios and everything was just brilliant. I think the best overall leader, although very difficult to deal with at times, and I had, you know, many altercations with him, including him finally naming his succession program ABL, which stood for anybody but Lutz, was Lee Iacocca. Just a fascinating guy, tremendous communication skills, tremendous vision, extremely quick minded, putting disparate facts together, and he would sometimes sit in a meeting and he'd listen. He'd just sit there smoking a cigar, but it was okay back in those days. He'd smoke a Cuban cigar and he'd listen to all people around the table discussing it. And I think, is this leadership where the boss just sits there and says nothing? And finally, he'd interrupt whoever was talking. He says, okay, I think I got it. Look, the facts are, and he'd just give you this. Then he'd say, now here's what I think we ought to do. And first of all, and then he'd outline this whole action plan, and it had just all come out in 30 seconds, and we'd all be awestruck. And then there'd be...
He wrote a pretty good book, pretty good management book, too, off of that experience. I've heard from other businessmen. They keep that book on their shelf.
What, Iacocca?
Yeah, is it the Iacocca book? There's some good advice in there.
Bob wrote a couple good ones, too.
Yeah?
Well, he didn't mention my book, so he'd mention one of mine. But yeah.
Come on, Henry, let's keep with the program
here. Bob can do his own marketing.
Yeah. Now, he's a fascinating personality, and with an iron will, you know, he'd say, well... we've got a hot property with the minivan, and we're sold out. And everybody said, yeah, Lee, isn't it great? And he'd say, well, it's not great. We should be selling twice as many. He says, well, we're at full capacity in the Windsor plant, sir, and full overtime. He says, yeah, that's the problem. We're going to open a second minivan plant. And so everybody had visions of another 250,000 minivans a year. He says, we're going to convert St. Louis to minivans. And if you know, I wouldn't do that. We'll suddenly have too many and so forth. Second plant came on stream. We sold close to 500,000 a year. And then we did another 75,000 in Europe with the assembly contract that we had with Steyr Daimler Puch. So it was, of course, this was before Chrysler really got back into the pickup business. And it was the minivan saved Chrysler. Because the cars were then, as cars are now, profitless prosperity.
Yeah. Hey, we got a couple of phone calls. Carmen, let's bring in the one from Dale.
Greetings, gentlemen. This is Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio. First off, John, I want to extend a heartfelt thank you to both you and Katie. You made an old man very happy. Secondly, Mr. Lutz. Recently, our public library had a book sale, and I was able to purchase every single book that you wrote.
And I there you go. There's your plug. Thank you.
There's another 10 bucks. Once I started, I read all of them in 3 evenings, and they actually made me feel like you were sitting in the room with me reading them to me. Excellent job waiting for the next book. Thank you, and everybody have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye-bye.
Awesome. That's great, Dale. Thank you.
That was an easy question to handle.
Yeah. All your books in three nights?
It shows you, maybe it shows you the level of intellectual content, easily digestible.
Actually, I've read your books, too, and they read very easily. You don't struggle through them at all.
They're designed to be that way.
Yeah. Hey, we've got another phone call. It says here from Norway. We got to bring that in.
Hey, guys. This is Henning Chensley from Oslo, Norway, calling. I have a question for Mr. Lutz. With GM all out of Europe selling off Opel, is there a business case for GM reintroducing some of their brands, primarily made Cadillac and Chevrolet? They have some great products that should be coming out, especially in the EV segment come through the years. And personally, I drive a 2014 Cadillac ELR, one of the very few here in Europe, and it gets tons of attention and praise wherever I take it. And I just think there should be some demand for these great GM products coming forward. How should GM pursue a new reentry strategy in Europe? Thank you.
Well, I can't answer for GM, obviously, because I've been gone since 2010. But for as long as I was with GM, the European operations lost money. And it was always, well, we need another couple of billion dollars and then look at our new product plan and so forth. And it just never worked. It seemed like no matter what we did, we could not reverse the constantly declining sales numbers for Opel and Vauxhall. Saab we never should have bought. That was a mistake. That was a panic reaction when Ford bought Jaguar and Aston Martin and Land Rover, Range Rover, and then the GM, they ran around and said, all the European luxury brands are going, what are we going to do? Well, there's Saab. Oh, yeah, buy it, you know, so... Ford even had Volvo, so they'd kind of scooped up everything. And that was a perennial money loser, and it was always, you wait till next year when we come out with the new models and we will turn this trend around, and never did. And it was the same thing with Opel. It was just, every time you looked at the business plan, it was a hockey stick. And year after year, you know, the low point of the hockey stick got moved out another year, but the year after next, boy, it's really going to go up. And it just never did. They never solved the German Union problems. It was just a mess. And General Motors, in my estimation, again, I don't know, speculation, is now in the phase where they see that the automobile industry globally has plateaued. There are two markets in which you can make big-time money, called China and the United States. And those are the two that General Motors is going to stay in. And if you do too well in those two markets, what happens in Europe or arguably other regions almost doesn't matter. And I think General Motors is in the mode of never want to get caught short of cash again, because last recession, 07, 08, we thought we had plenty of cushion to weather a recession. We had like $15 billion. Turned out that lasted exactly 3.5 quarters. And Ford, thanks to Alan Mulally's, I call it partly luck, partly foresight, had accumulated $30-plus billion and mortgaged the whole company. And that $30 billion saw them through the trough. And I could go endlessly on about it. Wasn't that it was better run than any other car company. They just entered the recession with a bigger cash pile. But I think General Motors would like to be like Toyota, where there is no cash pile too big to do two things. One, weather the next recession, which will come. We just don't know when, but we'll have a downturn. General Motors wants to get through that painlessly. Secondly, I think General Motors wants a big cash pile, because when the big day comes, when the major urban centers of the world become dominated by robo-taxis, which will be bought by the big fleets, 50,000 at a time. You know, Uber says, we think for next year, we need 200,000 minivan modules. We'll put it out for bids. Here's the spec, and here's how many we want. Here's the delivery date. Give us your bid. When you're into a commodity like that, where you're selling to a third party, you lose control over pricing. And the automobile business becomes like the cell phone business, as, you know, Nokia found out. Mm-hmm. But where will the value be? Where will the value equation be? The transportation service providers. Well, to become a transportation service provider, you need the capital to own your own fleets. And you need, you know, and I think that is, a GM sees the future coming and wants to be there as a global owner of the transportation fleets. And the factories will merely be supplying the value-creating transportation.
They want to be the cell phone companies. They want to be the AT&T. They're the ones doing the subscription contract.
Quite smart. But yeah, that's going to take a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a transitional period. To answer the question, Europe, General Motors is still selling specialty products like Corvettes and Cadillacs in Europe. And that, of course, is a minuscule quantity because there's not much distribution anymore. But it maintains a presence, and the cars that are truly special and not competing directly against European brands that offer exactly the same thing, I think it can be modestly successful. But I would venture to say that the height of GM's European ambitions right now is to sell a handful of Corvettes and Cadillacs per year in Europe.
You spent a lot of your career in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
For three different companies, GM, Ford, and BMW.
That's correct.
In fact, didn't you run...
I'm even a European by birth.
By birth?
Yeah.
Didn't you run GM of France earlier in your career?
No, I was general sales manager of GM France.
The reason I ask, I remember there's an old picture of you with Charles de Gaulle.
Oh, yeah. That was when I was general sales manager of GM France. He visited the stand. And we had a mid-engine Corvette on the stand, powered by a four-chamber Wankel motor.
And, oh, wow.
And there was an extremely attractive model in a silver, skin-tight silver jumpsuit, with all zipped up the front. And the President de Gaulle and I were discussing whether the car or the young lady was more attractive. And General de Gaulle said,
"The young lady come with the car.
I like the car, but it comes in second." And I said, "I agree with you, mon général."
Bob, speaking of Cadillac, I just did back-to-back Lincoln and Cadillac programs, drastically different brand models and how they're going after the luxury market. Where do you see those two brands going? You think Cadillac can compete against the Germans the way they went to? And do you think the Lincoln sort of quiet luxury Lexus-like service model can work?
My personal belief, and not necessarily shared by, in fact, probably not shared by General Motors, is I think Lincoln is on a more predictable track, because trying to outdo the Germans, even if you do it with the car, it will take decades for the public to realize that Cadillac CTS handles better than a BMW 3 Series or a 5 Series. And even if they do realize it, other than the hardcore of automobile enthusiasts, most of the American public couldn't care less. They're buying a monthly, they're paying a monthly lease, and they want a brand where when they put the key fob on the bar top, everybody says, "Wow, you have a Mercedes," or "Wow, you have an Audi." And for Cadillac to regain that status, no matter how great the cars are, is going to take forever. And I think Ford has always been very successful, and GM's pride absolutely prohibits GM from doing this. Ford has no such pride. If they see a European brand that has a look that triggers a prestige response in people, they will shamelessly imitate it and always have.
Yeah, put a Jaguar grill on the Lincoln.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Aston Martin grill and a Bentley grill on the new big Lincoln Navigator and so forth. A lot of people say the new Lincoln Navigator actually looks better than the Bentley Bentayga. And
does.
I agree with them. And it's probably a better vehicle.
Yeah.
And so that's always worked for Ford. And it worked for the Fusion. And it works for Lincoln. And I think that Bentley-esque front end is an absolutely brilliant stroke of design. A designer who takes pride in his or her profession is going to say, well, but that's shameless. You know, how can you call yourself a designer when you let yourself be inspired to that extent? And the Ford designer would rightly say, hey, we're not in this for art's sake. We're in this to sell cars. And at the end of the day, that's true. And I think Ford, the two Lincoln crossovers, which are both brilliantly executed, and I haven't looked at the numbers, but I'm sure they're vastly outselling the Cadillac XT5. Somebody would,
Dr. Data,
whip out your laptop.
I don't have the XT5 numbers. That's the unfortunate part.
But I think the Lincoln off of the Fusion architecture probably is outselling the similar size Cadillacs. Is it as great a car dynamically? Probably not. But again, the people who care, like the four of us sitting in this studio, that the number of people who really care about that stuff is just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And you can ask the average guy, is your car front-wheel drive-based or rear-wheel drive-based? I don't know. It's all-wheel drive. Yeah, I know it's all-wheel drive, but is it based off of a rear-wheel drive architecture or a front-wheel drive architecture? They don't know, and they don't care.
Mm-hmm. And yet, folks like us, I think, drive conversations to the point where, as you said earlier in the conversation, if Corvette did an SUV, it would have to be longitudinal engine rear-wheel drive,
and
just like
reason,
what Porsche
The reason
does.
You want that is because your market acceptance is going to depend largely on what the media say.
Mm-hmm.
And in that price class, people do read the reports.
Yeah, there's hope for us yet.
Yeah. Hey, look, guys, we've gone a lot longer than we normally do in a show. It's all been totally worth it, but we're probably going to have to wrap up at this point, just because if not, we're going to be here another 3 or 4 hours. We probably should be doing 3 or 4 of these shows.
You should have stopped me in time.
No.
John, can I ask a last question?
Yeah, go ahead.
So Bob, if Tesla is not a viable business model on its own, then who should buy it?
Well, first of all, you have to ask the counter question, why would anyone? And the only answer I can see is you'd buy it for the name and the reputation, because I don't think there's any battery technology or autonomous vehicle technology that isn't basically available to everybody else. So my guess is if someone were to buy it, it would be to acquire a very valuable brand. Would it be General Motors or Ford? I doubt that very much. Could be one of the Europeans. Could be an Asian producer.
Tata.
Could be a Chinese producer wanting to own a very, very powerful and legitimate brand. Or it could even be somebody who is not in the automotive business, like a Google or an Apple or one of the Chinese electronics companies. But that would have the problem that, once again, it would remain a small car company, not embedded in a larger automobile company where you have shared engineering and shared fixed costs. So it would remain a small, vulnerable producer. And the ownership would be in the hands of people who don't understand the car business, which, you know, is always a problem.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the other things Tesla's looking at, such as an electric semi? And, you know, they're taking their car batteries, too, and making power walls that you can put in buildings and the
like. Well, that's been the whole power wall thing at Solar City has been an unmitigated 100% flop. I think other than Tesla executives, I don't think there's two dozen Americans who have put Solar City power walls in their houses. As for the electric semi, I think both of those were pushmobiles. You know, they were elaborate things made out of a wood framework with plaster of Paris troweled on them. First of all, the total semi market in the States is so tiny annually that even if you dominated it, you're not talking very much volume. And secondly, every semi manufacturer, whether it's Freightliner,
Daimler,
that's Freightliner.
Oh, it is. Yeah. But Volvo
and et cetera, and even Cummins is coming out with a fully electric drivetrain for heavy trucks. So, again, not their primary business, and it would be hard to see that would in any way improve the fortunes, because you're not making a bold entry into a gigantic market. You're making an expensive entry into a market where if you are successfully able to take business away from equally capable competition, it's still not worth it. And most fleet owners tend to stay with the same brand. So if you've got an interstate trucking company that owns like 1,500 Freightliners, and Freightliner says, we'd like to sell you 10 of our electric Freightliners, that's who they're going to go with.
Yeah.
In terms of a company buying Tesla, another car company, what would the advantage be for them? The name, but it would no longer be Tesla, right? I mean, it would be...
What you're really asking is, can you separate Tesla, the brand, from Elon Musk, the personality? And you could argue either way on that. And I think that's one of the reasons why the board may be reluctant to replace him, because mm-hmm. I think most other boards would no longer countenance a CEO who has made such blatant mistakes that they result in a criminal investigation by the SEC and the Justice Department, which will effectively preclude him from raising capital. So by his intemperate remarks, he's really painted him into a corner. Any CEO in any large corporation would be on his way out. But I think the Tesla board frets and says, yes, I know, he's a problem child, he's volatile, he's unpredictable, he's gotten us into a lot of trouble, but what would we be without him?
He's Steve Jobs. He's the vision.
Yeah.
Hey, look, we're going to have to wrap this up. We're going to go on another 4 hours easily if we don't cut it off right now.
It's been fun again.
Bob Lutz, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I always love it.
Yeah. Henry Payne, good having you on the show always.
Thanks
for coming back. And Gary, it's always fun to do shows with you.
That's true. Yeah.
And, of course, want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.